Welcome to the Crexie Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director at Crexie, and today's host. Each episode, the Crexie team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining this episode of the Crexie Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to CRE newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director. And today on the mic, I'm joined with Eli Randall, our Chief Operating Officer here at Crexie. Eli, welcome to the podcast.
Ashley, thank you. Appreciate it.
Really lucky to have you with us today.
I am lucky to be here.
Today, we are thrilled to sit down with Bob Knackle, head of JLL's New York Private Capital Group. Before we dive in, a little about our guest. As the head of JLL's New York office, Bob leads the New York Private Capital Group. Bob was chairman and founding partner of Massey Knackle Realty Services, New York's number one building sales firm. He started his career in 1984 at C.B. Richard Ellis, where he met Paul J. Massey Jr. They both left C.B. in 1988 to form Massey Knackle. From 1988 to 2014, Massey Knackle closed over 6,000 transactions, with an aggregate value above $23 billion. To date, Bob has been personally responsible for selling over 2,000 buildings, generally considered the highest total ever for a single broker in New York, and over $18 billion in sales. In 2014, Cushman & Wakefield acquired Massey Knackle. At Cushman & Wakefield, Bob acted as chairman of New York Investment Sales. He was ranked the top originating investment sales broker at Cushman & Wakefield globally in 2014, 2015, and 2016. Bob joined JLL in September of 2018. Since 2009, Bob has written a weekly column on the New York City real estate market called Concrete Thoughts for the Commercial Observer. Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Ashley, great to be here today and nice to be with you as well, Eli.
Thank you, Bob.
We're so excited to have you. So I know that we just went over a little bit about your background, but why don't you start us off from the beginning? Where'd you come from? What have you been up to? How'd you get your start in commercial real estate?
So I got into the commercial real estate business completely by accident. So I'll take you back to 1981. I'm a freshman at the Wharton School. In the early 80s at Wharton, everybody wanted to be in the next Gordon Gekko and a Wall Street guy, so I was no different. I spent my spring break freshman year driving around Bergen County, New Jersey, which is where I grew up, dropping my resume off at every commercial bank and investment bank I saw. I was in Hackensack, came out of a Payne Weber office, and across the hall I saw Coldwell Banker. I went in dropping my resume off thinking the place was a bank. Set up an interview for the following day. This is 1981. There's no internet. I can't look the bank up. So I go to the library to look up this bank. So I knew a little something about the business. I see it's a real estate company. I almost don't go on the interview. But they were the only ones hiring college kids for the summer. I took the job, loved it from day one. I was in the market research department. I spent the whole summer driving around Morris County, New Jersey, logging in information on commercial properties. Went back my next summer to run that market research group. And then my third summer, I actually got my New Jersey real estate salesperson's license. And I spent the summer assisting an industrial broker showing industrial space to tenants. And then started with CB in Manhattan when I got out of school in 1984.
Can we go back a little further? So you're a fellow New Jersey native, like Ashley here, our host, must be something in the water.
There is.
Where in Jersey, what kind of kid were you?
Sure.
A little something on your parents and maybe what helped shape you into the path you went down?
Sure. Well, dad was a high school principal. Fortunately, not my high school. I felt bad for the my high school had the son of the principal was a classmate of mine, and it was a terrible life for him. So I'm glad I didn't go to my dad's high school. But dad was a high school principal, mom was a housewife. We grew up in the town called Maywood, New Jersey, which is a very small town. In fact, we didn't even have our own high school. I went to Hackensack High School. Growing up, sports was everything to me. We were playing sports after school all the time. At 6 o'clock, the fire department would blow the whistle, meaning all the kids went home for dinner. But it was either playing, football or basketball or baseball. And, so growing up, I loved baseball. In fact, I credit baseball with my affiliation or my affinity for statistics. Because growing up as a baseball player, I used to keep track of my pitching stats and everything. And so when I started in real estate, I started tracking stats very carefully as well. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I created that baseball card that I've used as a kind of an overview of my track record. But growing up, it was small town living. I still have a group of friends, the seven of us that went to kindergarten together that are still friends. We play poker once a year. It was a nice childhood.
Great. I've heard rumors about your baseball prowess. But that might lead me to my next question. If you didn't go down the path of commercial real estate, where do you think you could be today?
Eli, I've had that question asked me a number of times. I've never given an answer because I truthfully don't know what I would do. I feel so lucky that I stumbled into this business. I think it's the greatest business in the world. I love it as much today, if not more, than when I started. And I can't even imagine doing anything other than selling buildings.
Thank gosh for Caldwell Banker, huh?
That's right.
Well, that's awesome. I'm sure you had a lot of mentors throughout your life, right? A lot of people that are in sales were in sports. That's where their first mentors came from, or even before that with their parents. So talk to us a little bit about some of the mentors, either early on in your career, further back, or still to this day.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the folks who's really been a mentor to me that I've always looked up to in the business is Steve Siegel, who's the chairman of Global Brokerage at CBRE. Steve, just a fantastic guy in every way, real estate professional, great human being, philanthropic. I've learned so many lessons from him just chatting. He probably doesn't even realize the lessons he's taught me because there just could be a little comment made here or there when we're having lunch or just bumping into each other at a networking event. But very, very impactful. I think Steve is really a true legend in the industry, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him over the years.
Is there anything that sticks out to you in your mind? So any one-liners or anything that's really kind of shaped you?
He said to me one time, Bobby, you got to be a voracious reader. Read everything you can. Know everything about this business. And I really took that to heart. And so I love reading about many different topics because I think it's not just about real estate and about who's doing what deals. If you think about our business, a lot of it deals with selling skills, with human behavior, psychology, persuasion. And there's so many great books out there that teach so many good lessons about why people do what they do. And if you think about real estate, it's a relationship business, it's a people business. And I think it's so important to understand why people do the things that they do. And what we're all trying to do is get people to say either yes or no to what we would like them to do. And understanding those things helps provide a basis for trying to direct things in a way that will help you and your clients achieve their objectives.
For sure. I think that's super important in sales in general and just having that kind of emotional intelligence. But you can always learn things, right? Knowledge is power. So can you give our listeners some of the books that you've read that have been impactful or that maybe some people should pick up?
Right? Sure, absolutely. And if anyone would like the reading list, I'm happy to send it to you. Just email me. But some of the great ones, I love Jim Collins' Good to Great, where he talks about how great companies have a hedgehog concept where they think about the one thing they can do better than any other company and focus all their attention on achieving that objective. But there's The Power of a Positive No, which is a great book by Bill Urey, the Harvard professor. I love Bob Cialdini's work. He's the head of the psych department at University of Arizona, probably the leading authority in the country on persuasion. One of my old Wharton professors, Richard Schell, has written a couple of great books, the Art of Woo. I love the Harvey McKay stuff, Dale Carnegie, Keith Ferrazzi, Never Eat Alone. So many great books out there that teach you things that, you know, and in these books, if you look at my library of books, I have highlighted stuff, dog-eared pages, written with a pen in the margin. And there are things that you don't just read once and then leave on the shelf, but you occasionally go back and look through stuff. And you really can learn so much from the hard work that people have put in to try to educate us about those things.
And do you still read in the physical form, or have you moved to a Kindle or something along those lines?
Eli, I'm very old school. I love holding the book in my hand.
Music to my ears. I have a long debate with someone about that, but that's great.
You know, and sometimes, you know, one of my favorite places to read is poolside in the summer. And, you know, some of the pages, you can see evidence that there was water in the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
I still love reading in hard form.
So you mentioned an impactful mentor. What about mentees? Before we started recording, we were going through a long list of standout Massey Knackle professionals who are now doing really impressive things. Are there some standout mentees you're really proud of? You know, some people doing amazing things that stand out in your mind?
Well, I have to say, I'm very proud of all the folks that we've worked with. I mean, this is not an easy business. And I think it requires a level of aptitude relative to the subject matter, but then also tremendous discipline to do what sometimes are mundane things, but to do them over and over and over again. Cold calling, for instance, which really is the gasoline for the engine of this business as a broker. It's monotonous, but you have to have the discipline to do it over and over and over again. And a lot of the folks that we trained took that to heart, learned it. So many great people have come through our process. There are 10 or 11 companies today in the investment sales arena that are either owned by or run by ex-MK folks. And that's something we're very proud of. And I want to see them all do very well. As long as they're not competing directly with me on a particular deal, I want to see them do great. But, you know, several standouts. James Nelson, absolutely won. I gave James his first job in the business. He was my assistant way back when, and he's just flourished into such a great professional. But Shimon Jacoury, Ofer Cohen, and I shouldn't have gone down this path of naming people because I'm going to leave folks out. So I just say, you know, we're working on an idea to talk about how the company has impacted the business moving forward. And I always heard stories back when I started in the business about how Helmsley Spear was such a great training ground for people, and that so many businesses, both on the principal side and the brokerage side, kind of emanated from the Helmsley Spear environment. And I like to think in a small way that maybe MK had the same kind of thing, that we're impacting the horizon of what investment sales is today, at least in the New York City market.
I think that's happened for sure. Quickly, before we shift gears, you acknowledge and mention the monotony and the repetition of the job. And having sold 2,000 plus buildings, you know, when you do a deal today, is the thrill gone? And if not, how do you preserve it? How do you get excited by each new deal? Or is there an element of, you know, I have a playbook and I kind of go through the motions?
Yeah, Eli, I think that I still get as excited by the wins. One of the things that drives me, I'm very, very competitive. And so there are different stages where you're able to get that dopamine rush that everybody talks about today from these little successes. The first one comes when you either make the call or get the call and the client says, hey, I'm thinking about selling my building. That's like, all right, let's go. Let's put the uniform on and go to work. And then you go look at the building, put the presentation together, pitching business. That's the World Series of the industry, I think. I only work on exclusive listings, so getting that exclusive is a big thing. That's a big, big positive rush when you get awarded the assignment. And then you have to go to work and do the nuts and bolts of implementing a marketing process, making sure you're getting the highest possible price. And then signing the contract is another big victory. That's another, exhilaration when you get the contract signed. The closing is almost a little anticlimactic because overwhelmingly when you sign a contract, that transaction is going to close. But I think it's a matter of putting things in perspective. And real estate is very much a probability business. So I know, for instance, in Manhattan, using that as a microcosm, south of 96th Street, there's 27,649 buildings. On average, over the last 40 years, 2.6% of that stock has traded in an average year. About half the stuff that goes on the market actually trades, which means one out of every 20 people that you speak to are going to say, yeah, I'm interested in selling. So you have to have that mindset so that if 19 people in a row hang up on you or say no to you, you have to be feeling pretty good. The next one's going to be a yes. And so I think very much it's having expectation about what's likely. And that helps you go through this task of making the calls and doing the things you have to do. But most of what we do in investment sales brokerage is blocking and tackling. It's not rocket science. We're not curing cancer. We are doing things that are very routine, but have to do them over and over and over again. And hopefully we learn the marginal benefit that we get out of history and of having experience is that, people say, well, Bob, that's great. You sold, actually, as of last week, 2,253 properties I've sold in the city. But that the benefit to a new client of having that track record is I believe I've seen every tactic that a buyer or a seller can use to get an advantage in a negotiation. So I always try to use that experience to benefit my client to get them the best possible deal. So that's where it's not mundane and routine. That's where it really becomes art. And the art is crafted by all of the feedback and experience that you've had in all these different situations. So I'd say the business is probably 80% mundane blocking and tackling, and then 20% is that artistic part of it where you have to have dexterity, you have to adapt to changing circumstances, you have to apply what you've learned in other transactions to get this one into the end zone. And so that's the part of it I really love. I don't mind doing the routine cold calling and things like that. I still have a goal every week. I want to get to 100 property owners and get around to asking them if they want to sell. That's number one objective. But then I also love that applying the art of what we've learned to result in the best outcome for our clients.
Absolutely. Bob, that was great. I'm not a statistics person at all, so my mind was a little bit jumbled there. But in sales and cold calling, you always want to get the no so that you can get the yes, right? You're looking for that yes or no. I think you mentioned that in one of the books, but kind of tracking up towards those no's to get the yes. So I know we were saying about 80% mundane, the act of the sale, 20% the art of the sale, right? So give our listeners a little bit of the lessons that you've learned in that art, maybe some favorite mistakes that made you course correct or anything that you've learned along the way to help out some of our younger folks.
Gosh, Ashley, I will tell you that we, unfortunately, at the very beginning of starting our company, we didn't do one thing that I recommend everybody do, and that's seek out older folks or more experienced folks who have been there and done that and ask them a ton of questions. So consequently, we've made thousands of mistakes. We hopefully learned from them, didn't make a lot of them twice. But you need to make mistakes because if you're not making mistakes, you're not pushing yourself hard enough, I think. But that one mistake was not asking people who have been there and done that for their advice or input. I think so many lessons learned. In fact, I gave a speech at Columbia a few years ago, and the professor whose class I was lecturing in asked me to put together a summary of the lessons learned, and I came up with a list of 26. And interestingly, two or three of them applied just to real estate. All the rest of them applied to sales generally. Many of them were like life lessons. So I think it was really interesting. I think, you know, realizing that the business is a marathon, not a sprint. Realizing that your reputation is everything, that you have to make sure you're doing everything that's in the client's best interest. I tell people today, treat every client like they're your mom or dad. Like, what would you tell your mom or dad if they own the property? And to not think about necessarily making the deal, think about preserving the relationship, and the deal's a byproduct of the relationship. I also tell young people today, find something you really have passion for, right? And if you want to be in real estate, there's a million different things you can do. If you want to be a real estate broker, there's so many things you could do. You could rent apartments. You could sell apartments. You could be a mortgage broker. You could raise equity for people. You could be a sales broker. Even on the sales broker side, is there a certain type of building you're going to sell? Is there a certain neighborhood you're going to work on? Is there a certain transaction type? But I think that the biggest lesson, the biggest takeaway, I think, for success in the business is to be specialized. Because if you are specialized, that enables you to differentiate yourself from the thousands of other people that are trying to do what you're doing. That differentiation creates a competitive advantage for you.
And Massey Knackle was certainly built on that specialization. At least the way I understand it, your team members were experts on, you know, each property, each block, each neighborhood. Is that accurate?
Yeah, Eli, the way we set up the company, which again, I have the mindset, it's the late 80s, the amount and quality of publicly available information was very limited. We had this big, thick blue owner's book. It was half inaccurate. You'd flip to a property, call the owner, and then you dial that number, and they say, "Oh, he passed away 30 years ago." The geographic orientation that we had, and we put a broker in a neighborhood, and then someone next to that broker, someone north, someone south, and grew it like a jigsaw puzzle. And it was all geographically oriented. We wanted to know everything about what was happening on every block. And we'd literally go on the block and call around, call every owner, go to the next block, call every block, every owner. And that gave us the ability to go into a client and say, "Look, we haven't sold that many buildings. You're talking to other firms that have sold a lot of buildings, but the three buildings that we've sold so far, one was down the block, one was across the street, and one was right next door to you. So we can be a better advocate for you in terms of convincing a buyer why they should pay more for your property." And that got us a lot of traction. Today, I think because the amount of publicly available information is voluminous and it's also highly accurate. I mean, you go online, you can get somebody's address, their cell phone number, their shoe size. You get just about anything on people today. I think that product specialization has become much more important. So I think that if we were starting MK today, it wouldn't be as effective with the geographic approach. I would have a product specialization approach with a geographic approach layered on top of that, because I think you also have to be working in a specific defined market. And I think this whole concept of specialization is one where you need to have an area of specialization that's small enough that will allow you to articulate a very, very deep level of expertise in that area, but yet large enough that you can make a good living. You could be the greatest expert on one square block, but you can't make a living doing that. So, you know, it needs to be the right size. And I think for investment sales, having anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 targets is probably the right size to be able to call people three times or four times a year, send them mail regularly, send them text, meet them, do all the things you have to do. I think any more than that is too many. Any less than that is you're not working hard enough. But for what I do, private capital, investment sales, I think that's a very good size target market.
And going back to the lessons learned, maybe mistakes made in the early years, and I will ask a question that redeems this one, but any deal regrets, any listing you turned down, you thought the seller wanted way too much, or, you know, buyer you didn't take seriously, anyone stand out to you like, got that one wrong a little bit?
Well, Eli, you know what's interesting about this business is that when we work on these deals, we are living these deals so much. You know, the calls, everything is very meaningful, impactful. I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, but you talk about a deal from 1992. I probably tell you the buyer, the seller, the price. I remember, you know, showing the building. I think, though, as much as I remember the deals we closed, I remember the ones that we didn't make, and those still bother me. And one of the things, this is a mistake that we made in the early days that we quickly corrected. The best thing you can do as a broker when you don't get an assignment is wait a couple of weeks, call the seller and say, hey, I didn't get the assignment. Please tell me, what could I have done differently? Why did you go with the other folks? And I think that you learn much more from your failures than you do from your mistakes. And I always do that. I'll always call the client and say, how could I have done better? What could I have done differently? Why did you go with them? And it's really that is probably the best feedback you get about how you're doing what you do. It's better than hearing it from your colleague or trying to guess at why you didn't get it. That's very, very instructional to get that direct feedback from clients.
Feedback is such a gift. That's awesome. And I love that. So kind of switching into things that you've learned, maybe from mistakes or lessons or things, what is part of your regimen on a daily basis? Now, you mentioned you wanted to make a certain number of calls a week. You still have those goals. So tell us a little bit about the work ethics, maybe that started early or that have progressed throughout your career that you make sure to do every day, every week, every month.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. And that's a great question. And I've rarely been asked that. But, you know, I've been working for over 10 years now with a broker coach, Rod Santamassimo of the Massimo Group. Fantastic. I mean, I owe a lot of my success to Rod. He's been a great mentor, coach, friend. And we've gone through different stages in our coaching. At first, his typical program, we were tracking 8 or 10 metrics every week of what we were doing. We got to the point where we were tracking over 100 different things down to, not, of course, you're tracking how many calls did you make, how many mailings did you do, all that kind of stuff, how many buildings did you go look at. But we were tracking things like, how many green juices did I have in a day? Or, you know, did I eat too much red meat? Or, you know, tracking all kinds of stuff. And one of the most interesting things, I think, in the business of brokerage, between 9 and 5, we're in what we call the whirlwind. And in the whirlwind, you're busy trying to advance your objectives. You're reacting to things that happen. So you have to be productive outside of that 9 to 5 time. You have to be proactive before 9 o'clock, after 5 o'clock, on the weekends. And what I found, initially I had a goal of waking up early to make sure I could have a productive 2 or 3 hours before 9 o'clock. And what I found was that I was misguided in setting a goal of waking up early, because you can't wake up early unless you go to sleep early. So the goal actually transitioned to getting to sleep early, which allowed me to wake up early. And so sometimes you go through this trial and error with these different things you're doing. But, you know, getting plenty of rest is important to me. Waking up early, getting to the gym, get my workout in. You know, I'm 60 years old. I have a 14-year-old daughter. I want to stay in good shape, so I keep chasing her around for a long time. So I make sure I get to the gym almost every day. I do that for first thing in the morning. And then I also, one of the other things that's really critical for me is blocking out time to make my prospecting calls. If you don't block that time out at least 2 weeks in advance, you just won't get it on the calendar because it's going to be booked up with things. And my assistant, Denise, is constantly putting things in my calendar. I basically go where she tells me to go. But if I hadn't blocked out chunks of time, and they're always 2 or 3 hour blocks to make my calls, you won't have any time to make those calls. So you have to be very disciplined about managing your time and keeping your calendar properly.
Follow-up question to that. I think you answered part of. I have this theory that most, maybe not all, great salespeople have a physicality to them. You see them on the phone, they're punching, they're projecting, they're, you know, it's almost a sport in their mind, perhaps. You know, what physical health advice would you give to young brokers? Like, how do you stay on top of that game?
Yeah, just you have to stay in shape. I think, you know, the most difficult challenge that we all have is finding balance in our life, right? And that is, there's no one formula for everybody. That balance is different for everybody, but I think everyone should track career time, family time, friend time, health, spirituality. Your faith is important. So I think, but the balance and the amount of time you spend on each of those things is different for everybody. So I think figuring out what your right balance is and making sure you're doing the things that are going to help you achieve your objectives and to think about proactively where you want to be in a year, in 3 years, in 5 years, what you want to achieve, and to think about those things very proactively. You know, so often what brokers do most commonly is we spend all our time every day working in our business. But it's important to take a step back to work on your business. And working on your business are things like having your coach and thinking about, okay, do I want to be selling a different type of property? Do I want to sell in a different area? Do I want to have different tools that are going to help me achieve success? Should I be thinking about a different prospecting program? Should I take a class on real estate tax? What can I do? You have to take a step back and figure out where you want to move the battleship, because when you're on the battleship manning the guns, you're not thinking about where it's going or how fast it's going. And those are the things you focus on when you take a step back to work on your business.
I agree. I think that you said a lot there. I think that first and foremost, when we talked, I think it was a year ago at this point, you said that you're always constantly networking. I think that you're doing one event every day, year. Is that what you strive for?
I try to do one every working day.
One every working day.
About 261 a year, I think.
Which is really hard.
And that can take the form of going to a conference, going to mm-hmm. a seminar, going yep. to a meal or a drink with a client, mm-hmm. or just popping into somebody's office to say hello. But mm-hmm. I think networking is a fantastic thing. I try to do a lot of it. I meet folks. I make sure that the people I meet, they go onto one of my mailing lists, so I'm keeping in touch with them. But again, this is a relationship business, and the more folks you know, or more importantly, for what I do, I think it's not who you know, but who knows you.
Yep. I saw that on your Instagram the other day. Yeah. I loved it. I loved it. And you create your own content as well. So
yeah,
I love it.
I love to create content. I think that's important. Yep. But absolutely, networking is really critical. You want to be out there and you want to be top of mind with people. For mm-hmm. if you think about the statistics I gave earlier on the turnover ratio, it's very small. On average, what the 2.6% turnover ratio means is that when someone buys a property in Manhattan, they own it for 40 years before they sell it. So they're not always going to have something to do. So you want to be on top of mind when they decide, hey, I have to sell the building. And there are a number of triggers that make that happen. The old reliable death, divorce, taxes, partnership disputes. Something will happen and an owner will say, you know what? I really should sell my building. The first thing you want them to think after they think that is, let me call Nackle and talk to him about the building. So how do you do that with all these different things that we do? I'm a big proponent of hard mail. Like I think email has become so prevalent and people get so saturated that there are times when they're hitting the delete button because they want to empty their box out, maybe not paying as much attention to each individual email. And with hard mail, we always thought that the impression of seeing your name, seeing the company name was important. Even if someone picked it off their stack of mail, looked at it and threw it in the garbage, to me, that was success because if they saw that a real estate person sent them something and they throw it in the garbage, they probably don't want to do anything right now. And they're seeing, Bob Knackle, then throwing it out. But then that one random Wednesday when they decide I have to sell my building, let me call that pain in the neck who's sending me all that mail, right? So it's stuff like that that you want to be top of mind. Networking is a great way to stay top of mind with folks.
Absolutely. So jumping around a little bit, I'd love to dive into the story of Massey Knackle and learn more about the legendary brokerage that you had. So how did you start the firm? Maybe give us a little insight on some of the building blocks that helped you create that. Take us back.
Yeah, well, you know what, Ashley? We based it on the very simple residential formula of farming. In residential brokerage, a residential broker will pick a neighborhood and they walk around and meet every owner of every house on the block. And that's exactly what we did. When we started out, we had sublet an 850 square foot office, three rooms. It was Paul, myself, and the secretary. And we each had our initial territories, and then we hired our first salesman, Ed Winslow, and he was in the territory to the north, and we hired Jim Ventura, and he was in the territory to the south, and we just kept growing like a jigsaw puzzle, and the growth was relatively slow. You know, people think it was an overnight success. It was a slog for a while. When we started in November of 1988, on 9/11, we had 21 people. And so that was 13 years and 21 people. But then there really was an inflection point on 9/11. You know, it was a terrible thing for the city. A lot of companies were downsizing. People were concerned there might be another attack. What's going to happen? Brokers were being let go. Lawyers, accountants, really great quality people were out of work. And Paul and I said, you know what, this city is tough. We're going to bounce back. And up until that point, we were both interviewing every candidate for a job at our firm. We're like, we can't spend the time to do this. Let's go hire a director of human resources and hire all these people. And within a year and a half, we were over 100. A year or two later, we were 150. And that was a very, very risky move that we made at the time because it could have sunk us. But fortunately, it didn't. It was the right thing. New York did come back strong. But it was, just a lot of fundamental stuff back in the early days, making your calls and sending out your mailings and meeting folks and doing all those very fundamental things that are part of the blocking and tackling of brokerage.
And Massey Knackle is very, you know, synonymous with New York. It evokes a lot of feelings about New York City, and you guys have helped shape this great city in many ways. How has the city changed, and how is it the same in your opinion?
Oh, I think the city has changed dramatically. I think if you look back to the 80s, the neighborhoods within Manhattan even were very, very different. Like Tribeca, which is like a booming, great, hip, cool residential neighborhood, was a place that if you were in Tribeca after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you were doing something illegal. It was not the place people wanted to be. Meatpacking, the same thing. If you were in the meatpacking district after 3 o'clock, there's some illicit stuff going on down there. But it seems like how the city is transformed is that the island of Manhattan has become very homogenous. Every neighborhood is great. And what has happened with Brooklyn and Queens, so many of those neighborhoods are rivaling Manhattan in terms of rent levels and occupancy and attractiveness and willingness of people to live there. I remember we had another inflection point in the company when we filled up all the geographic territories in Manhattan south of 96th Street. And we said, okay, what do we do now? Do we get into office leasing? Do we get into retail leasing? Do we sell more buildings? And we said, you know what? We don't know anything about those other businesses. We know how to sell buildings. Let's open up an office in Queens. A lot of buildings in Queens. So in 1999, we opened up our Queens office. It was, at the time, some people were like wondering why we were doing that, because the perception from Manhattan brokers was, if you go over the river, your shoes are going to get dirty. Why would you want to do that? But we looked at it and said, well, 27,000 buildings in Manhattan, there's over 50,000 buildings in Queens in the investment sphere. You look at Brooklyn. We, after 2 or 3 years after we opened Queens, we opened a Brooklyn office. And Brooklyn, that was before Brooklyn really became hip and cool. And it was such the right thing to do. So I think that was another thing that really helped us, is we fortunately had the luck of foresight being accurate, that we thought these neighborhoods were going to do really great. And they did. And so we were there before anybody else really was there, and brought that that Manhattan type of institutional approach to building sales in the outer boroughs. And it worked out great for us.
So a lot of change to the demography and even the shape of the city in many ways. What do you think just can't change, stayed the same, still, you know, the soul of the city in a sense? Like, what would you say hasn't changed?
Well, I think the desire for folks to be here. I mean, the city is just full of opportunity. You know, the cultural aspects, the nightlife, the vibrancy the city has. Notwithstanding what we went through during the pandemic, I think that affected every city and every neighborhood everywhere. But the city just has a life and a vibe to it that is tough to find anywhere. And I know a lot of folks from New York have moved to Florida, some of them moving back. And the folks that are moving back are saying, just, you know, it's beautiful in Florida, a lot of economic development, people moving there, markets are doing great, but I missed the feel of the city. And I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
It's the greatest city of the world, hands down. I might be biased being from the Northeast, but there's just a vibe when you get in here. We were talking about that today. It's just, it's an energy. It's a lifeline. So,
you know, look, there are a lot of great cities in the country, a lot of great places to live. And I'm very myopic in my thinking because I've lived in Manhattan for 39 years. So I'm clearly biased. But it's a really, really cool place.
Absolutely. So, Bob, leaning into that a little bit more, tell us about the current state of the New York City market. Give us your 30,000-foot overview. Where are we at? What has changed since the pandemic? What asset types are thriving versus not? Give us a little bit of insight into that.
Yeah, well, Ashley, that's a great question. I think I'll start by, you know, I always, one of the benefits of all the gray hair is that I've seen a lot over the years. So what the one thing that I'll say is the most different about what we're going through now is, and it's very different from the savings and loan crisis in the early 90s, the recession in the early 2000s. We saw a slowdown in volume, but not a reduction in value in any of the years during that recession. Very different from the great financial crisis, 2008-2009, is that in those other periods, every product type was moving kind of in unison. Maybe the percentages were a little different, but they were all kind of either going up, down, however they were reacting. It was very highly correlated. This time around, I think the biggest difference is that each product type is operating very, very differently. And what I mean by that is if you look at the multifamily sector, cap rates are up because lending rates are up, but there is tremendous demand, and that demand is from a very diverse group of buyers from all over the country, all over the world, looking at multifamily in New York. It used to be very New York-centric. It's not that way anymore, but there's still a very, very almost counterintuitive amount of demand for residential multifamily, notwithstanding the political headwinds that exist in that space today. So that's a big, big surprise. In the land market, the residential rental land market has basically dried up. Then we're in fact telling people not to sell because without a tax abatement program, it makes no sense to sell your property today. The condo market is moving very well at a new reset price. The Fed started raising interest rates in March, didn't really start to impact the lending market tangibly until September. That's when spreads really blew up. And so construction loans got so expensive that it reduced land value in Manhattan by 20 to 25%. But at that lower price point, there's still a lot of interest in land in the city. The office market, very, very opaque. Office is really the tale of two different markets in that new construction Class A office is doing great, tremendous demand, great rents. And the reason is that it's very difficult to convert an older building to compete with a newer building. You can't change ceiling heights. You can't take columns out. You can't do things that newer buildings offer. And so newer buildings are doing great. Everything else is facing challenges. Challenges attracting tenants. We could have very, very significant vacancy in the city. And so I think the city needs to implement incentives for the private sector to convert a lot of that older obsolete office space into housing. We need the housing. We don't need the office space. Let's figure it out. Please bring back the 421G that worked so beautifully downtown. But we can convert a lot of this empty obsolete office space into housing. And then you look at the retail market. The retail market's a bright spot. Actually, retail rents have been sliding for years. It's generally perceived that although rents are well below where they were at their peak, they've stopped going down. Leasing activity is picking up. For the last 2 or 3 months, we've been getting calls from retail investors asking what retail properties we have for sale. Hadn't gotten those calls in years. And so each sector is kind of working differently. The perception is that based on the governor's proposed budget, the assembly's proposed budget, and the Senate's proposed budget, it looks like there will be a housing shortage for the foreseeable future. So residential rents are probably going to be going up. So if your rent's too high, blame your local politician, because they're the ones creating a constrained supply, which is doing nothing but exerting upward pressure on rents. In fact, every piece of legislation that has impacted housing that's been adopted within the last 5 years or ignored in the last 5 years has done nothing but exerted upward pressure on rents. So we see in the office sector, there's downward pressure on rents. In the residential sector, there's upward pressure on rents. So the difference between today's market and similar periods in the past is the way the different sectors are behaving almost mutually exclusive from each other.
And what advice would you give to either younger brokers or investors who maybe haven't gone through this before? How do they navigate the market shifts and what do they do at this time?
Yeah, we have a lot of young folks in the office and they're very, very nervous. They haven't seen anything like this. Yep. And I tell them, look, the reality is the market has been, is, and always will be cyclical. This is actually a time when if transaction volume is a little slow, brush up on your skills, learn something new, put yourself in a position to take advantage of the market when it comes back, because it definitely will come back. And in every new market, coming out of the S&L crisis, coming out of the early 2000s, coming out of the great financial crisis, there have been new investors that have emerged, new brokers that have emerged, new market participants have emerged that have all of a sudden catapulted into the upper echelons of our business. And that is a great thing and should be very inspiring for young folks.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that advice because sometimes people get a little nervous, but it's just, you got to go through it to get out of it, right?
It's going to come back. It's going to be great. It always comes back. It will come back. The markets are cyclical. That's just the reality of the world we live in.
Yep, absolutely. Well, to finish us off here, we have a couple of rapid-fire questions that we always ask to ask our guests, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
So we'll kind of just fire them off right here.
Sounds good to me.
First and foremost, if we were to give you $10 million today and you had to invest it immediately, what would you invest it in? Would it be asset type, location, and why?
Two things. One, I would buy properties that are close to transportation hubs in the outer boroughs. increasingly the city is going to have to increase density around transportation and probably decrease density further away from transportation. They've already been doing this, but I think that is going to continue. I think that's a great investment. Secondly, I would buy land. I would mothball it for a few years. I think if you look at the historical movements within the land market, the best sites in Manhattan, for instance, in 86, 87, they were $125 a foot. In 97, 98, they got to 350 a foot. 06, 07, 750, 16, 17, 1100. They went down into the 300s, got up to, and that was in 2020, got up to about $500 a foot in early 22. Now they're heading back down again. I think you, as you see, the peak of every successive cycle has greatly exceeded the prior peak. I think land is going to go way up when the market comes back. It's going to bounce back on a higher percentage basis than any other property type. And I would buy land, just sit on it and get a 2X, 3X, 4X on your money.
There we go.
Plenty of land to be found on Craigsy.com.
There definitely is.
Shameless plug. So you're fortunate to have so many great restaurants in this city, some of which I'm sure reside in buildings you've sold. Paint the picture of the best closing dinner restaurant right now for you.
Oh, the best closing dinner restaurant. There are so many, so many. Now I'm going to get in trouble again. But I love Come Prima on Madison Avenue between 72nd and 73rd Street. Great food, nicest people. I haven't had a closing dinner at Marjorelle on East 63rd Street yet, but I love that restaurant. My wife and I, it's our favorite place to go to. Del Frisco's, Mastro's, so many great places. Now all my restaurant friends are going to get so mad at me for not mentioning them. But I think that, you know, we used to have great closing dinners in the basement of the 21 Club when it was open in that secret room, which was great. But there's always a new place popping up also. And so, you know, we're always trying to try new places.
Mix it up, try new places.
Yep, absolutely. So, Eli, you did do a little Craigsy plug before, but this won't be a trick question for you. What is your favorite tool or software to use on the job?
Well, it has to be Craigsy. No doubt about it.
I mean, come on. What do you know?
Yeah, no, it's, you know what? I just, one of my weaknesses is that I'm not very technologically advanced. I just started using social media in January of this year, which has been a great thing. But I think that one of the things I'm working on personally is to try to use technology a little bit more. So, I have a great team of folks who support me that are on different technologies all day long. But, I still write a lot of stuff down online, pads of paper. That's my system.
Same. I carry a lot of paper with me. we try to put it all in our CRM, but pen and paper, reading the books, underlining it. As we were talking about before, I can't really share books with people because they're all my notes in all of them. But, you know, if you want a book, I will share it with you.
So I warned you I'd throw some curveballs. It's not a crazy curveball, but off industry. What's a piece of music, a band, a musician that you've brushed off recently and just said, damn, that's still good.
Well, you know what? I used to, believe it or not, in college, I developed an affinity for two types of music. One is classical. Vivaldi is one of my favorites. I could listen to the Four Seasons over and over and over again. And I love smooth jazz, believe it or not.
Cool.
You know, Brian Culbertson, Joe Sample. There's so many Miles Davis I love. That's a little bit more jazzy than smooth jazz. But Gabriella Anders, Sabrina Claudio, there's a lot of smooth jazz folks I love to listen to.
Great.
I love that. A lot of jazz bars in the city too. So you can definitely get a lot of that. What's the most common misconception about your job or the industry in general?
The biggest misconception, that's a great question. I've never been asked that. I think the misconception is that it is a very cutthroat business on the building sales side. I think that there is an element of that on the mortgage brokerage side, because mortgage brokers never work together. A mortgage broker from one firm won't work with one from a different firm. But on the building sales side, we're often co-broking. So, I'm happy to count amongst my friends a lot of brokers who I compete with regularly. You see them out at networking events, and it's great to see them, give them a hug, talk about what's happening in the market. And I think that the perception is that there is a very a visceral negative competitiveness, where I don't think there really is. Because there, if you think about it, there's so many buildings in New York that rarely are you finding yourself competing head-to-head with the same folks over and over and over again. Maybe on the larger institutional quality assets, the same groups are going against each other, because there aren't that many that do that type of business. But in the private capital space, if you're selling a $20 million or a $50 million building, you're going up against different folks all the time. So it's not as negatively competitive. And I think there's kind of a spirit of collegiality within the industry that I really think is a cool thing.
So I'll just close. Curious, any advice for your younger self, perhaps 16, 17, 18-year-old Bob Knackle, what would you tell yourself?
Well, Eli, sometimes I joke around and say, you know what, after high school, I should have come to New York and gotten my license and started selling. I would have had 4 more years of experience under my belt, but I say that only half kidding. The college experience is a great thing. Go to college, it's a good thing. I would tell myself probably to have figured out a way to keep in touch with folks that I've met along the way. Now, take it back to 1984, no computer on your desk, no cell phone, no fax machine, no nothing. So I've lost touch with a lot of the folks I went to college with. There was no way to really keep track of people. And that's a big advantage that folks have today. So I tell young kids, I talk to college students quite frequently, and I'll tell them, keep track of everybody you're meeting. And 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, the kids sitting next to you in class is going to be the CEO of a company, and maybe you can do business with them. So take advantage of all these great tools that you have today to keep in touch with folks, because you may be doing business with them decades in the future.
Great advice.
I love that. You've said so many things in this podcast that I've personally taken to heart. I love the managing your time, managing your calendar, putting everything on it, making time for the physical, the mental health, plus the work, your family. I think you schedule lunch or dinner with your wife at a certain time every week. You told me that a year ago, and I loved that. But anything else that you want to say to our listeners before we take off here today?
No, this is the greatest business in the world, and I think one of the characteristics we see in people who do the best is a real passion for the business. So if you're listening to these words now and you've sat through this whole podcast, you probably have a passion for the business, which is a great thing, but follow that passion. The passion is the thing that leads you to be able to and gives you the ability to get through the tough times that you have. And no matter how great you are, you're going to have tough times. You're going to face challenges. Passion is what will allow you to get through those tough times and ultimately succeed. So develop that passion. If you have passion for this business, follow that passion, encourage, feed that passion, and great things can happen.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us. It's been awesome. I know our listeners really appreciate hearing all of your insights. So thank you. Bob, if our listeners want to get in touch, how can they reach you?
Always feel free to send me an email, bob.knackle@jll.com. That's K-N-A-K-A-L. So bob.knackle@jll.com. And I'm happy to interact with you.
Awesome.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexi.com/podcast. That's go.crexi.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexi podcast on your favorite podcast app, or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexi for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.